How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Wrestling Observer Live. We're here every Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 Eastern on the Sports Byline USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 92, 94, 794, XM Radio Channel 208, streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. We got a very special show this week. In the studio right now is Lance Storm, former WWE, WCW, ECW, Japanese pro wrestling as well. Lance is here. We're going to talk about his career for the next 2 hours. Joined, of course, by Mike Sempervivi of the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare up at WrestlingObserver.com. And should be a fun time. We've interviewed Lance about a million times on our regular shows over at WrestlingObserver.com, but it's been many years since we ran down his career, and never before here on Wrestling Observer Live, so a big treat for everybody here today. And Lance, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
And Mike, how you doing?
I won't complain.
Mike, you're way out there on the East Coast, man. What's going on?
Not a whole lot. It's, you know, it's not as nice as having Lance in the studio here. I'm here all by myself, so I feel a little left out. But thank you for letting me on the line for this.
That's right. Lance is here on vacation. And next year, we're going to get Mike Sempervivi out for WrestleMania, which is halfway. Actually, a lot less than halfway from Delaware to Seattle, but one of these days we'll get him out here as well and do a show live in studio. But Lance is here, and so we're going to be jumping into his career. Been pretty much all over the world, and we're going to really kick into it after the first break. But Lance, just very quickly before we go to the break, how have you been enjoying the Seattle area?
I really love Seattle. I've been here a couple times. I think it's a beautiful city. I love the water and the greenery. Calgary's a lot drier, so it's not quite as pretty.
It's very woody here.
Yes, lots of bush, lots of green, and lots of lakes. I grew up where there was a lot of lake, and Alberta is lacking in lakes. We've got some great mountains, but not a lot of water.
All right, well, when we come back, we're going to start talking about Lance from day one. My wife was shocked to hear that you were a volleyball player early on. She just absolutely could not believe this. But we're going to talk about that and breaking into wrestling and your entire career here when we come back from the break. So stick around, everybody. We got 2 hours with Lance and Mike. Back in just a moment, Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here, WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We are here every Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 Eastern, Sports Byline USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio, Tri-Channel 92, 94, 794, XM Radio Channel 208. We stream live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. You can find us all over the place on your smartphone as well. The TuneIn Radio app, the Sirius Satellite Radio app, iHeartRadio, iHeart.com, number of different places. We're also joined today in the studio by Lance Storm, who is here to talk about his career. And we're going to get into a lot of the lot of different aspects. I'll let Mike ask you a bunch of questions from your Japanese stints early in your career. And we'll get into some WWE, WCW, ECW as well. But from the very beginning, Lance, you when did you first see professional wrestling on television?
I honestly have no idea the first time. My dad was very anti-pro wrestling, so I didn't really watch it much when I was a kid. Although I do remember flipping by channels and thinking I might like it and want to watch it. But my father was ever the skeptic and thought if you watched pro wrestling, someone might think that you believed in it, and therefore they might think you were stupid, so he didn't want us watching it. So I only saw bits and pieces when he was out and working on the weekends, and I could catch something. I think the first show that I purposefully caught was an AWA show that featured the Road Warriors, because I had just seen the movie and thought it was extremely cool. And I was flipping channels one Saturday afternoon, and I think Ken Resnick was pitching to commercial with, up next after the break, the Road Warriors. And I thought, the Road Warriors? That's got to be cool. So I hung around purposely to watch the rest of the show. And then these two gigantic crazy dudes come out and beat the holy hell out of somebody. And I made a point of watching after that.
The Road Warriors.
Yes.
Not the most technical wrestlers.
No, but if you're just an impressionable kid, boy, they were impressive. I was a big Road Warrior Hawk fan, more so than Animal. And later on in my career, we can get to, I ended up meeting him a few times, and he was a really cool guy, so that was pretty cool.
Now, you obviously, one of the things that people talk about is your physique. And obviously, throughout your career, you know, I'm sure you've had the steroid accusations before. But I think we talked a long time ago that you have a theory that if you start, this may have been you, start working out at a really young age and really get into weight training, you build a foundation that lasts you through the rest of your life. And I know that certainly I, when I was very young, I did gymnastics and I got into weight training and all that stuff that I did when I was, you know, 13, 14, 15 years old. I built up a lot of strength that I still have to this day. When did you first get into weight training? And presumably from looking at you, it came easy.
Yeah, I started really young. I would have been about 12 and a half years old when I got my first weight set for Christmas. And my dad, he comes from a large family, 9 brothers, 2 sisters. And several of my father and several of his brothers were into weightlifting and so forth. So when I got the set of weights, my dad, fortunately enough, worked out with me and taught me how to lift properly, which I think really helped. And I think it certainly built a good foundation. I was also blessed with really good genetics. My dad was really well built. He was shorter, but had a really good build. And I had several uncles that were big guys and had worked out. So I think I had good genetics, and then starting young and training properly. I'm a big proponent of good form and training smart, which I did right from the get-go at, from 12 and a half on till now. So for a really long time. And even if I take a bit of a break, whether I'm injured or what have you, I find that it all comes back fairly quickly, that muscle memory is a great thing. And starting so young, I think, really helped.
Now, Lance, you obviously liked weights, but did you like any other sports or like playing any other sports? Or as a kid watching wrestling, did you think, I need to get into amateur wrestling or anything like that? What were your athletic, you know, achievements and activities, you know, besides weight training growing up?
I pretty much played any sport I could. I was pretty much a school sports guy. If there was a soccer team in, you know, grade school, I played on the soccer team. I played on the volleyball team. I played on the basketball team. If there was track and field, I did that. By junior high, again, I played baseball. I played volleyball. I played basketball. And I did track. And as I got into high school, I focused more into volleyball. It was a football school. And going into high school, everyone's like, well, you have to play football. That's what men do. And as soon as you tell me something I have to do, shoot, I decided that I would do something else. So volleyball and football were playing simultaneously. So I decided to go volleyball and buck the system a bit and just fell in love with that game a lot. And that became my prime focus. But I still did a little bit of track. It was a case of we didn't have a real strong track team at our school. So I didn't really want to do track each year. But when it came time for the big city meets, the gym coaches that gym teachers that I knew really well would sort of come. It's like, okay, we don't have anybody doing high jump. Can you do high jump this year? Or we don't have anybody doing pole vault. Can you do pole vault this year? Or we're short one guy for the 4x1 relay. So I did whatever they needed each year for track, although I didn't actually train for the events at all. I just did them. But volleyball and basketball and pretty much anything at that point, I never really thought of getting into wrestling till, again, much later, pretty much right before I got into it. I never even considered it. I was going to school, get an education, going to get a real job.
Lance, you're here in Seattle, and I dragged you to our my jiu-jitsu school. And Mike, you should have seen this guy on the mat. It was like Brock Lesnar showed up at the dojo, just mauling people left and right. And you, Lance, have never done any amateur wrestling, but you've been told by people who are actually very good at amateur wrestling, extremely good, in fact, that you would have been a hell of an amateur. Why no amateur wrestling?
I grew up in Northern Ontario, and amateur wrestling wasn't an option in school. It wasn't something that they had or did. Southern Ontario, when you got down to Toronto and stuff, they did. But
no, like, local clubs or anything? Nothing?
Not that I knew of. And I didn't have a whole lot of money as a kid. So, you know, I didn't do any sports outside of school because you didn't have to pay for them. Other weightlifting once I got a set. But I just trained in my basement and played stuff with my, you know, my friends. But there wasn't organized wrestling that I knew of. So I never had a chance to try. And just to finish the story, it was Kurt Angle that told me that I would have made a good amateur after the one singles match we had on, I think it was SmackDown once. That he thought I had, you know, good balance and, if nothing else, good instincts on the mat, I guess. But yeah, I had zero, well, I shouldn't say zero. I think we had two gym classes in high school that we covered amateur wrestling. I can't remember any of it, but it would have been two 40-minute classes. And then no jiu-jitsu whatsoever other than the class I did with you.
But you picked up everything very fast, which actually doesn't really surprise me because, I mean, obviously as a wrestler, you've got to learn. I mean, the moves you're not really powerbombing. I mean, you are. Everybody knows what I'm talking about here. But the point is, like, you got to learn different moves. And you picked up everything really quick. And the one thing that I noticed more than anything else was that you had a great base. You had great balance and good top positioning, I guess would be the best way to describe it. Did you, I mean, when you first went to Japan, we're jumping forward a little bit. I mean, they obviously, you know, they train their guys in the dojo and a lot of the guys have to do, they got to shoot. I mean, did you do any of that when you were there, or did you have any sort of, because you had talked about how sometimes in your school, you'll get in the referee's position and you'll have someone try and put you on your back. And I don't think anyone ever has put you on your back, which is saying something. I mean, you have to have had some sort of training in this somewhere at some point, correct?
No, not really. I wouldn't say training. It's I had an older brother.
Mm.
And
that'll do it.
Yeah. So I was fighting with my older brother on a regular basis. And again, it was never serious fighting where we're punching each other in the face trying to kill each other. But it was, you know, grabbing him, holding him down, trying to wrestle, contain, and everything else. So we had no coaching and no training, but I technically grappled with my older brother, and he would beat me up until I got big enough to finally put him through a wall, and then we stopped. So I've anything that I have, I've just picked up instinctively. And then with your class doing jiu-jitsu, I watch and pay attention when I watch mixed martial arts, because I find it very fascinating. Even back to the old Shamrock Gracie where they laid on the ground for a half hour, I enjoyed those. And when you watch and pay attention and have good instincts, I guess it comes naturally.
All right, we're going to continue on with this after the break. I gotta get more details about putting the brother through the wall, whether this was literally or figuratively. That's after the break, everybody. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here, WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We are here every Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 Eastern, on the Sports Byline, USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 92, 94, 794, XM Radio Channel 208, and streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. We have Lance Storm here in studio, joined, of course, by Mike Sempervivi. And we're talking the career of Mr. Storm. And in the last segment, you talked about grappling with your brother, who was bigger than you for a long time, until you said you were bigger than him to put him through a wall. Did you put your brother through a wall, Lance?
Literally, yes, I did.
Wow. Tell me this story.
And again, I'm not certainly pleading innocence and everything, but my brother used to instigate a lot and beat me up and big brother me, I guess. And I remember my mom once saying to my brother that you realize one day he's going to fight back and be bigger than you. And
I swear to God, I don't mean to interrupt your story. I tell that to people at my school all the time when they mess around. You know, they've got the kids class or they've got the younger kids and, you know, they're bigger and they do this sort of thing. And these kids are going to grow up, you know, they get big.
Yep. And my brother sort of joked and said, yeah, I know. And when I do, I'll stop. And I remember it like it was yesterday. We were at our cottage and it was over something stupid. It was the volume on the stereo. I had turned it down and he turned it back up and I turned it down. And he turned it back up. And I decided at this point I was done being bullied by my brother and turned it up and kept my hand on it and said, you're not moving this. And he decided to, and we got into it, and I did pick him up and charge right for the wall. And we put a huge hole in the wall. And that was the end of it, and we never had another fight.
I think the most important question really is there is, what song was stuck on when that happened? Was it like, you know, a funny moment with like a love song on, or did it was like Street Fighting Man on and you beat him up to it?
It would have been my brother's music, so, and actually if I had to guess, it was probably something by Devo. He was into them before they were popular for that brief period of time. I'm guessing, but it would have been something that he was listening to that I decided I didn't want to. And I put him through a wall, and that was the last fight we ever had.
My question is, when you put him through the wall, did pyro go off?
No, it wasn't a wall like the WWE entrance wall.
That's disappointing. That's disappointing. That's a hell of a story. Now, you, I believe it was your stepfather passed away a couple of years ago, and you told the story how, I don't know if you didn't really realize it until after he'd passed away, how much he helped you in your career, or if maybe you'd kind of always known, but didn't really think about it until afterwards. But tell us how he helped you with your wrestling career and how you owe a lot to him.
The first thing was having him in my corner financially. I was in university and not happy and was considering getting into wrestling. And I caught the train home and met him at his work and had a meeting with him and just said that this is something I was wanting to do. Wasn't sure if I would be able to afford it all on my own or whether my mom would be able to back me. And I said, if I knew he was in my corner, it would really help. And he said, absolutely, I'll be in your corner. I don't think I ever needed financial help from him, but he was there. But when I decided to get into it, I really had no idea how. And he was the one that took the bull by the horn, so to speak, and started making phone calls to try to figure out how people got into wrestling. And he contacted the Hart Brothers Pro Wrestling Camp in Calgary. He contacted the Power Plant in Atlanta and even managed to get put through to Jack Tunney's office in WWE back when Jack Tunney was the figurehead president of the World Wrestling Federation. And I remember him telling me that Jack Tunney told him that they got all of their talent through amateur wrestling. And when he told me that, I'm like,
worker.
Yeah, I'm like, he's lying to you. That's not where they get their talent. And he was like, really? So he phoned him back to call him on his lie. And I eventually got through to Jack Tunney again. And Jack Tunney wasn't too happy about being called out by someone I'm quite sure he thought was a mark. And eventually told him that, sir, to be perfectly honest, I'd just as soon not bother with you, and hung up on him.
Wow.
And I remember thinking at the time, and I never ended up having the option, but at that time I was a bigger WCW fan than I was WWE because I liked more serious wrestling, obviously. So at that point I made a note in the back of my mind that if it ever came to the point where I could go to one or the other and there was an offer there, I would have loved to have sat down and went to Mr. Tunney and said, sir, all things considered, I'd just as soon not bother and go to WCW. But obviously Jack Tunney was gone shortly thereafter. And I never had the chance to snub Jack Tunney like he did my stepfather.
Now, Lance, what were you doing at college? What were you studying when you decided that, hey, this wasn't for me? And obviously your stepfather was in your corner, but was your mother in your corner as far as what your career plans, what you wanted to do?
I was getting a business degree. I was in advanced business at Wilfrid Laurier University. I was going to be an accountant, believe it or not. I was planning on being a chartered accountant. And university just, it was a bad volleyball coach really took the fun out of university for me. So I started looking for something else. My grades were getting worse because I wasn't enjoying university. And I was toying with the idea of pro wrestling. And it was my roommate at the time, Bruce McGregor. And if you're out there anywhere, shoot me an email on Facebook or Twitter or something, because I've lost touch with him. He's the one that sat me down and said, perhaps your grades are getting worse because you want to be forced to make a decision. And that's when I made my decision. My mom really wanted me to finish school first, but she's always been in my corner and backed me and said she would support me. But she did make it very clear she would have rather I finish university first. I told her that really, if I stay in university any longer, I won't have the option to come back because my grades were getting worse. But I said, if I get out now, I can always come back and pick up where I left off. So I gave myself I think it was a 5-year window that if I hadn't made reasonable progress in 5 years, then wrestling wasn't going to be for me. And I'd go back to university and finish up with my degree.
Now to steal a phrase blatantly, Lance, why so serious? This is, for those that are unaware, this is no gimmick. Lance is a very serious man. This, his stern face is, it's rare that you will see even a family photo with Lance not giving the stern face. Have you always been a serious man?
Yeah, pretty much. And I think a large part of it was that my brother was a little more wild and crazy, and I tended to be the opposite. I saw his shenanigans, for lack of a different term, and thought he was fairly out of control. So I've always been very big on staying in control, which I think is one of the reasons why I never drank. The idea of getting drunk and out of control didn't really sit well with me. So I've been a pretty sober, serious person my whole life.
What is your brother doing these days?
To be perfectly honest, I have no idea.
Really?
We've fallen out of touch the last few years.
Hmm. Now, the wrestling school, you finally got there to the Hart Brothers Wrestling Camp. Silver Dollar Action Center in Calgary, is that correct?
That's where it was held, yes.
Wow. Now, tell us a little bit about the Silver Dollar Action Center, because this sounds like the place to be.
Yeah, it was a, it was really a bowling alley that had a lounge, and a few banquet rooms where they did small concerts and so forth. And one of the banquet rooms is what the Harts rented out, or the Harts, it was Keith Hart, rented out the room to put the ring up in. But the guy that ran it for Keith was a man named Ed Langley, who lived in Okotoks, a small town south of Calgary, which is where we all stayed. I assumed that the camp would be taking place there because they told us to locate ourselves there, got us a deal on a hotel, a really crappy little hotel that we stayed in. But he had a van and he drove us in and out of Calgary to the Silver Dollar Action Center. It was a big pink building where we did the training each day. But when I arrived at that crappy little hotel, the Okotoks Inn, and saw the band of misfits I was be training with, I was seriously considering packing up, going home, and looking for a new school. It wasn't until I ran into Chris Jericho that I thought, well, here's an athlete. Thank God there's someone else. If he's here, maybe it's not so bad. So if it wasn't for Chris Jericho, there's a good chance I would have packed up, headed back to my hometown, and looked into the power plant in Atlanta.
Because you felt, I would presume, as a serious man, that when you saw this band of misfits, did you feel that none of them took this seriously? Was that the issue?
Well, I think I expected like a...
The WWF roster?
No, I think I expected like a university level or a NFL level tryout camp, where I figured that there was, especially with the size of pro wrestlers in the late 80s, early 90s, I was expecting a bunch of, you know, Davey Boy Smith, Lex Luger, you know, Road Warrior Hawk and Animal, a whole bunch of big guys like that, some big, huge athletes, and then maybe some smaller athletes like a Bret Hart and a Pill. I really thought I was going to be one of these smaller, less muscled guys that showed up. And I trained my butt off to be in great shape, hoping I'd be able to keep up with everybody. I thought I was heading into, you know, the NFL. It's like, well, this is a professional sport. And then you see some of the dreamers and small, skinny kids that were wrestling fans that show up to wrestling camps, or big, out of shape, fat guys. And there really wasn't. There was one guy that looked tough. He looked like he, you know, might have been in a motorcycle gang or something. He had a bullet hole in his leg, so he's, you know, he at least seemed like a tough, big, strong guy. Didn't look particularly athletic, but a big, tough guy. And then Jericho and I, and that was about it. That it's like, there's no way anybody but maybe us three are ever going to do anything in this sport. So until I had seen Jericho, I just like, what is going on here?
Well, Lance, I would think, you know, and on the surface, if one hears that you went to train at the Hart Brothers Wrestling Camp, that, you know, Stu Hart had 97 kids, most of them boys, so you'd figure you'd get a lot of hands-on with the Hart family. At least on the surface, one would probably think that going into their camps, but that wasn't really the case, was it?
No, which isn't uncommon with wrestling schools. There'll be a name on the marquee, and there'll be someone else training you. Keith Hart was the only Hart that ever showed up, and he was only there a few times. He was there at the beginning to collect all the money, and he was there a few days here and there, but really didn't have much to do with it. As I said, Ed Langley was a guy that was there every day telling us what to do, and it was a kid named Brad Young who did the actual in-ring training and demonstrating. He was actually a former graduate of a previous class.
We're going to talk more about this when we come back from the break, plus the first time he went to Japan. Also, ECW, WCW, WWE, the first super kick heard around the world. All after the break. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live, Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here, WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We're here every Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 Eastern, on the Sports Byline USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 92, 94, 794, XM Radio, Channel 208, and streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. Lance Storm is here in the studio today. We're talking his career. And Lance, I guess since we're talking the early portion of your career here, why Lance Storm?
It was really a case of me not being particularly creative. And it was just sitting down, I think it was Ed Langley, Chris Jericho, and myself, trying to decide what our names were going to be, because our first show was, in my brain, I'm thinking the first show was up in a couple days, but there was programs printed. So it was probably a couple days before the deadline of we need to print programs. What are your names going to be? And that was the best we could come up with. I never liked it. I thought it sounded fake. And I really just figured, well, I'll use that for now. I'll change it and use something better. But I never came up with something better before I started building some goodwill to the name that I ended up sticking with it. But yeah, before I was breaking in, I didn't think I'd have to have a gimmick name ready. So I never put any thought into it. I was worried about doing the job rather than coming up with the name. So I didn't have anything thought of.
You and Jericho ended up in Japan for, War Wrestling Association R, and, you and Mike can talk a lot about that, but, how did this get set up?
Well, we first went over for FMW. It was almost 1 year to the day of our first match that we got booked for a tour with Atsushi Onita's FMW first. War was, boy.
War was like 5 years later.
More than that. I think it was 96 or 7. Yeah, so 5 years later, I guess. But FMW was the first one. And it was a case of Fred Jung, a guy that booked a couple of our early shows that we worked for, had a connection with FMW through a guy named Ricky Fuji, who had wrestled in Stampede and had gotten to know Fred. So when Onita was looking for foreign talent, Ricky Fuji hooked up Fred Jung as a foreign talent agent, I guess. And Fred had booked Rick Bogner, who was the second Razor Ramon, if you remember him. They had booked him as Big Titan in FMW. And then when they needed new talent, Fred contacted Jericho. And Jericho, as a really good guy, said, well, I'm in a tag team. If you're going to book me, you need to book us both. So he got both Jericho and I booked. This was back when we were Sudden Impact, which was actually a name Fred gave us. And we got booked on that tour in October of 91.
As opposed to a slow, deliberate impact.
Yes, exactly. We did it suddenly.
How was Japan?
I loved Japan, although more War than I did FMW. While I did love the experience working in Japan for FMW, the style, for the most part, was a lot more blood and guts than I liked. Although we really didn't do a lot of that. We did just mostly wrestle. But
were you terrified going to Japan basically that earlier in your career, where you didn't have a whole lot of experience as it was? And were you familiar at all with FMW's product or with Japan at all before you went over?
Fred had got us several videotapes, because this was back in 1991. So we had gotten a lot of VHS videotapes of some of the big shows that FMW had put on. So we'd seen the barbed wire and the exploding bomb matches and all the crazy stuff that Onita had been doing. And I remember Jericho being concerned with, you know, we're going to have to go over and do all this crap. And I remember being far more calm about it, because I was thinking, it's like, well, I assume they had seen us wrestle, because I'm assuming Fred had given them tape, but probably not the case. But I assumed it's like, well, we're being hired because we're good wrestlers. Certainly they're going to make us wrestle. If they just wanted guys to bleed and fall in barbed wire, they would have hired somebody else. So I wasn't really expecting to do a lot of the other crap. I assumed that was the main event slot that Onita and his guys did, but we would for the most part wrestle. And I really wasn't nervous. And I think part of it was that there was a huge runaround, because Fred Jung, in my opinion, was a huge con man and was lying to us every step of the way. So we were dealing with so much BS from him that I was spending more time wondering if this trip is even going to happen, more so than what am I going to do if it does. And I've always had a really good, I've had a lot of confidence in my abilities in the ring. So as long as I can get there and get in the ring, I was fairly confident. The very first show when we got there ended up being in a main event match against Onita and a few other guys, which did make me a little nervous. But on the whole, I was fairly comfortable with my abilities.
Now, when he went later on to war, I think it was the, it had to have been the Skydiving Super J, which I think took place in 1994, and you were teaming up with Yuji Yasuroka. And I think that it had to have been the first time I had ever seen the move where you would lay down and roll the guy into a Boston Crab off the ropes, double-legged. And you did that a lot in ECW later on with one leg. But did you see that move somewhere? Did you come up with that on your own? Because, again, I think that probably was the first time I'd ever seen that. And I was always blown away watching it on the tape because it was just so fluid and smooth.
It would have been 96 or 97. Yeah, it was a Skydiving J. I stole it from Terry Taylor. I had seen him do it on, I think it was a Clash of Champions wrestling Bill Irwin, of all people. And Terry did it out of a double drop down. He would have the guy off the ropes. He'd do a regular drop down, and then he would drop down lengthwise and roll into the Boston Crab. And I thought, damn, that's cool. And I kept watching, and he didn't do it again for about 6 months. Well, I never saw him do it again. But after 6 months, I'm like, he's not doing it again. It's fair game. I'm stealing it. So I stole it from Terry Taylor. Was doing it into the folk Boston like he had. And then it was somewhere shortly after that that I realized it'd be a lot smoother if I roll to a single leg because you've got one arm free to post up better. So I switched it to the single to make it smoother. But I stole it from Terry. And then oddly enough, in I think around 2002, 2003, when I was in WWE, and Terry got hired as an agent, he was agenting one of my matches. He says, that rolling crab is really cool. Where'd you get the idea? And I just looked him right in the face and said, I stole it from you. He's like, I did that? I'm like, yep, you did it against Bill Irwin, and I told the story to him just like I did you. So now that he knows, he tells everybody that I stole it from him.
I've got to jump way forward because there's another great Landstorm story that I, honest to God, had never even heard until today. And I talked to Lance every other week for about the last 8 years. You went through the border, and the guy got really excited, the border guy.
Yeah, it was last year. I was on a family vacation in Ontario and drove back, crossed in Minot. I don't know whether that's in South Dakota, North Dakota, wherever the heck it is. And as I was pulling up, you could just tell that the guy in the border agent, while he's dealing with the car before me, is staring at me and looking at my vehicle like crazy. And I'm like, what's going on? And as I pull up, the guy looks like he's getting really, really excited. And I get up there and he asks for the passports. I hand him the passports and he looks at my passport. He looks at me and then he just gets all just chest fallen and disappointed. And I'm like, he opens his window and he's like, I thought you were Mirko Krokop. And I popped huge. I'm like, well, you're not the first person that said I looked like Mirko Krokop. He's like, oh, I was so excited.
It's the best story. I love that story. Now, you, in between, Japan, obviously, and before you went to ECW, you obviously had the stint in Smoky Mountain. And very famous story, obviously, was when Chris Jericho decided that he was going to do a shooting star press and nearly killed himself. And I was also aware until this weekend that your wife was the one who had to take him to the hospital.
Yeah, he had about a week before the Night of Legends event, the big one that we did in the Knoxville Coliseum. Jericho decided he wanted to try the shooting star press because he was still working in Mexico and Japan and was pushing the envelope of his repertoire. And on a house show somewhere, he tried it in the afternoon, completely blew it, come right down on his head. I thought he killed himself. And I ran to the ring. It's like, are you okay? He's like, yeah, I'm fine. Why? And he's got a bit of mat burn on his forehead, but he's perfectly fine. No selling it. And then we didn't have a chance to try it again until the Night of Legends. And we're going to wrestle the Heavenly Bodies. They're coming back from WWE to do this big show. And he asked Jim earlier in the day, it's like, do you mind if I go to the ring and try stuff? He's like, yeah, just don't get hurt. Famous last words. And he went to try the shooting star press, wasn't going to rotate it even close. So he bails out and ends up landing what looked like a, you know, perfect top rope drop kick landing. And he rolls out of the ring holding his arm. I'm like, something's wrong. Cause I was back of the arena when I saw him do it. So I went up and like, you all right? And he's like, well, my arm's funny. And he could push his arm in the middle of his forearm and it would bend in the middle. And it was like, oh my God, that's bad. He said, but it doesn't hurt. Can't be broke. I'm like, dude, your arm's bending. So my wife ended up taking him to the hospital. And he got x-rayed and was determined he had a broken arm. And she was the one that was sent back from the hospital to tell Jim Cornette that his big baby face for this big, huge Night of Legends broke his arm. He's still going to work, though, but he had to tell Jim Cornette that he broke his arm. And Jimmy had a tremendous freak out.
Killed the messenger.
Thankfully, it was my wife, so he didn't freak out big on her. But he did have a lot of really explicit language freaking out that this idiot managed to break his arm the afternoon of the biggest show of his life. But Jericho, he mentioned at the hospital he had to leave for this show, and they wouldn't let him leave. And he's like, well, I'm not going to wrestle. I'm just going to stand at ringside. It's like, well, you can't leave. So he had to escape because they posted a guard at his door. So he told them he was going down to the cafeteria to get some food and took a left when he should have took a right and ran out of the hospital and caught a cab and came back to the building and wrestled a match against the Heavenly Bodies.
Now, you train with Ed Langley and Brad Young. And then you went to Japan, which is kind of a completely different style. I guess you were still, like you said, you weren't doing like the hardcore craziness. You were brought there to wrestle, but then you end up with Jim Cornette, who's got a very specific idea of wrestling. What was it like working for Jim Cornette? I mean, was he the kind of guy the likes of which you'd never even seen before? Or I guess I don't know. I picture like the first time you meet Jim Cornette and just being around the guy, it's kind of like an eye-opening experience. Was it like that for you, or had you met plenty of Jim Cornette-like characters along the way?
No, I had not met plenty of Jim Cornette characters. I was a huge Jim Cornette fan, though. I was a big Midnight Express mark, because as I mentioned earlier, I loved WCW, and I thought the Midnight Express were awesome, and Jim Cornette was just an incredible talker. I loved Jim Cornette. So when he picked us up at the airport, when we first flew down to Smoky Mountain to talk to him, I was just excited to meet the guy. Really got along with him, thought he was great. And I'd actually had the stint in Europe, with Otto Vons right before I went to Smoky Mountain. And that was a slower style. So it wasn't as much of a culture shock as you would think. Because again, Jim Cornette really wanted his Southern wrestling because, well, we were in the South and that's what the crowd wanted. So it was a really interesting experience for me because our first program was with Well Done, who was very Memphis 101, which is, you know, real easy, slow walk and talk type wrestling. And Chris Jericho was working in Mexico with Ultimo Dragon, and in Japan with, you know, the fast paced junior heavyweight style. Sure. In Japan that it was really just taking off with, you know, the Jushin Ligers and the, Otanis and all the different guys that were in Japan doing such crazy stuff. So Jericho wanted to work 1,000 miles an hour. Well Done wanted to work about 5 miles an hour. So I ended up trying to be the ring general and bring these both entities together and somehow try to find middle ground. So it was an amazing experience. And also Jim Cornette being such a character and promo based guy. And I had no character and no promo skills at that point in time. So it was a real challenge for me because it was Jim Cornette wanted a very specific thing, and Jericho was working a lot faster than he wanted, and my promo skills were a lot more diminished than he wanted.
How long was it before you, we only got a couple seconds here. We'll talk about this more after the break. So actually I'll give you the question. You can think about it, and we'll talk about it when we come back. When did you first start to feel comfortable on the microphone and feel like you finally had a character that you could, that you could bring to television? I guess we'll start with that when we come back from the break. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here, WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com, and Lance Storm, who's here in studio. We only got a rather brief segment here, about 2 minutes, but Lance, when was it that you first felt like, okay, I'm starting to figure out this microphone stuff. I'm starting to figure out what my character is. I'm starting to feel comfortable as this person, Lance Storm.
I'd have to say ECW as far as a character. But as far as being comfortable talking, I would say really Smoky Mountain was the only time I wasn't. Because before that, when I was working in Europe and Japan, it was such a sport-based thing. You didn't need a character. In Japan, they just wanted you to talk like a real athlete, and that I could do. I could express, you know, how I was really feeling about a real match. But in Smoky Mountain, you had to have a character. You had to tell a specific story and act a certain way. And I really wasn't that thrill-seeker personality, so I wasn't what my character was supposed to be. It wasn't until ECW that I really found who Lance Storm was. Up until that, I was just Lance Evers, wrestling under the name Lance Storm. But ECW and Paul Heyman, that's when Lance Storm became a real entity, and I felt comfortable being myself and could do what I needed to do in the microphone.
Very quickly here, why did Jim Cornette decide that you should be part of the Thrill Seekers?
It was a gimmick he had in his mind that he wanted to do. And when I sent him my resume, my videotape and so forth, I had a montage of what I did in the ring. And physically in the ring, I could do the high-flying Thrill Seeker gimmick. It's just, I'm not that person in real life. The, you know, go out and party, have a good time, thrill-seeking kind of guy. I'm the guy that'll go to the gym, go home and read a book. And since I hadn't actually developed a character, you got Lance Evers on the microphone and Lance Storm in the ring, so to speak. So I wasn't the thrill seeker personality, but physically and in the ring, I fit the bill for a character and a gimmick that Jim Cornette had wanted to do for a while.
All right, everybody. When we come back, we've got another hour with Lance Storm, and we've got a lot of stuff to talk about ECW, WCW, WWE, and Post. We'll talk about his wrestling school as well. You may want to be a wrestler. You may be that guy that wants to get training. Lance Storm School is a place to go. All that after the break. You are listening to Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Wrestling Observer Live. We're here for the next hour talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, joined as we are every week by Mike Sempervivi of the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare up at WrestlingObserver.com. We're here every Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 Eastern, on the Sports Byline USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 92, 94, 794, XM Radio Channel 208, streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com, the most listened to wrestling radio show anywhere in the world. And this week we've got Lance Storm in studio. We are talking his career. And a short segment here before we get into a longer one here after the break. But Lance, when you first went to ECW and you met with Paul Heyman, what are some of the things that Paul Heyman told you that really helped you develop the Lance Storm character?
I don't think it was really what he told me. I think he was smart enough to realize that you can't just tell a guy to do something. You have to let him find himself. And I'm a big proponent of finding yourself as a character. He saw that I had a good relationship with Chris Candido. We were good friends. Chris was the one that had put the word in for me and really pulled to get me a job there. So he put me into a program with Chris. That way Chris and I could find the conflict and the personality ourselves. And he just sort of encouraged us in different directions to see what we could find. Rather than telling me, okay, this is who you're going to be. This is how you have to act. He put me in a conflict with a guy that I knew. And I think he saw Chris and I, when I'm friends with somebody, I'm not quite as serious as you might think. And I do joke around and I'm a bit of a smart ass. And he saw personality, and stuff there between us. So he just put us in a situation and allowed us to develop it. And, Candido really helped and pulled a lot out of me. So my first promos were with Chris, who I was comfortable with. And it was from there that Paul managed to bring me into my own. And I think turning heel was a big part of that.
All right, we're going to do a break. When we come back, we've got more with Lance Storm, ECW, WCW, WWE, and life after WWE, his wrestling school, working in WWE developmental here and there, and a lot of other stuff. So it's all coming up after the break, everybody. Back in just a moment. You are listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here, WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com, here every Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 Eastern. Sports Byline, USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio, Tri-Channel 92, 94, 794, XM Radio Channel 208, and streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. Not only joined by Mike Sempervivi today, but Lance Storm is here in studio. We've been talking his career. We're getting into the ECW days. And Lance, it is 2013, 2014. We've had many, many ECW documentaries. We've had many ECW rebirths. There's even the Tommy Dreamer House of Hardcore. WWE has done a reboot. TNA has done a reboot. And looking back to 1997, 1998, your time in ECW, what would you say were some of the best things about ECW? And to you, what were some of the things that maybe the time were romanticized, but in reality, these were some of the worst things about the company?
I think probably they're both the same thing. I think the freedom as a performer, especially when you're young, you want to go out there and do everything you can. You know, you want to bust your ass and prove that you really know what you're doing and buck the establishment and, full speed ahead, so to speak. And that was really rewarding to have that, you know, that we really went out there and Paul encouraged that rebellious attitude of, you know, break down the walls, do what you think's right, go out there and do it all. And while that was really great, I think overall, I think there was times I'll go back and look at some of my stuff from ECW and knowing what I do now from my years, you know, since it's like, you know, we really should have had the reins put on us a little bit more. And obviously a lot of the guys that were doing a lot of the violence, and the, you know, the chair shots to the head and other stuff like that, obviously I think paid a greater toll later on in life, but it was just really rewarding to have the creative freedom. And I was lucky that I showed Paul that I had a good mind booking wise early. So he started letting me contribute booking wise. So I booked along with him a fair bit, pitched a lot of creative ideas for myself and other guys. And that was really rewarding. I learned a lot doing that with Paul. So that was probably the highlight. But I think in hindsight, you start setting tables on fire and doing barbed wire and different things. I think it started setting a bar in a place that our bodies couldn't take and jumping off higher and higher balconies and ledges, I think, did the industry a disservice in the long term.
Now, Lance, I didn't have access to ECW TV at the time, so I don't know exactly what happened here, but you talked about chair shots, and were you not dogged for a match you had against Rob Van Dam
that's
barely legal? And then on top of that, did that, because that was so early in your ECW run, did that reaction from the fans, were you or Paul, were you able to take that and mold that into the, I'm a serious athlete, not a chair swinging freak like these, you know, like Axel and Balls, or was it just coincidence that that happened?
It was just a case of I wasn't really familiar with the ECW product and how stiff a lot of the stuff they did was. And also, too, I had never really done a lot of hitting people with chairs, so I wasn't comfortable smacking someone in the head with a chunk of steel. So my chair
did
shot...
Did you ever hit anyone in the ear?
No, I did not. But also, too, it's like, and I'll stand by this, if you go back and look and compare the chair shot I did on Rob that night with a lot of chair shots you see in wrestling outside of ECW at that time, I think I threw a perfectly acceptable working chair shot. It's just ECW stopped working their chair shots, you know, a year before that. So in ECW, they're expecting you to just hit the guy as hard as you could, and I didn't. Although in hindsight, it did lead up to I hit him with two or three weak ECW chair shots, and he ended up Van Damminating me with the chair as a receipt. So it ended up telling a better story. It made perfectly sense in the match. I didn't hit him hard enough, so he kicked the chair into my face, and the crowd popped like crazy. But they did give me a hard time about it, and even now, God, 15 years later, I get people that, what was up with those chair shots?
You should say I was right.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I do.
I was ahead of my time. I was conscious of concussions. But at that time, I was just working like the arena shot a month while I was still working in Japan. So I didn't really turn it into my character. But on the few shows that I did start working it as my heat where I was working with, you know, Axel or something and he'd be doing the hardcore. And then I would not, sort of a page out of what Foley did there briefly, but it was sort of the he's soft core. I'm not going to hit the guy really hard. So I started for a little while just on the live events that I was doing between Japan shows, working exceedingly light and the crowd would boo me like crazy. And then when the babyface would appear to work far stiffer, then the crowd would be all excited. Although fortunately when I was working with some guys, they were good enough to make it look like they were working a lot stiffer than I was. So the crowd would get all excited about it. And then I'd do some extremely worked stuff and they'd get really hot at me. So I did that briefly before I got into the angle with Candido when I decided to stick around full time with ECW.
Well, Lance, what, you know, not to take it back to you being a serious guy again, but you know, after, you know, your experience of going into the camp and then going to Japan and going to a promotion with all of that violence and going over to Europe, and I'm sure seeing a lot of things while guys were on tour, and then you walk into that locker room and that company with that reputation, at any point is it bouncing around in your mind that all of these people are nuts? I don't think I can continue to do this, just because, not because I don't want to do it, but these people are all crazy and I just don't want to turn out to be crazy.
No, because I think ECW gets sold short. And again, if you weren't watching the TV back then, it may be that you didn't know, but there was a lot of great wrestling in ECW. And there was a lot of freedom. There was, you know, Rey Mysterio and Psicosis doing high-flying lucha. There was Dean Malenko and Eddie Guerrero doing some of the greatest technical wrestling you're going to see. It really was a mixed bag in ECW. And like I said, when I went to Japan, I was very confident in my wrestling ability that I was going to come in here and do wrestling. And for the first while, I did. You know, I worked Rob Van Dam, worked with Chris Candido, worked a single match with Shane Douglas, one of my early ones coming in. So I was doing a lot of wrestling, so I was fine. Now, that said, the first time I worked with, it wasn't the first time, it was a tag we did with, it was Chris and I against Balls and Axel. And we were to take chair shots. One chair shot from each and go down, then one more when we were on the mat. And I unfortunately fed up in front of Balls, who just killed me with a chair shot to the head. And then when I was laying on the ground, instead of hitting me in the upper back, he managed to hit me low back and caught my pelvis, top of my pelvic bone with the edge of the chair. And I came back to the locker room, walked into Paul. I said, if I got to take another chair shot from that idiot, I quit. And I was still working in Japan at the time, so I could have. I would have been fine. It's like, I'm not getting killed taking this crap. And Paul said, fine. And the next night we had to work with him again, and the finish was changed, and I was hitting Balls with a chair. And right before I went out, Paul Heyman said, if that chair's not bent when you get back here, you're fired. So,
wow.
After complaining about getting stiffed, my punishment was I had to stiff others. But I didn't have to take the Balls chair shot ever again, and I was good to go.
Now, when you delivered this chair shot at Barely Legal, or the two to Rob Van Dam, the legendary ones, I mean, when you, after the show, I mean, the show was legendary in a lot of ways. And I mean, when it was over, I think, you know, by the time they did the deal with Terry Funk winning the title, I think that most people had long since forgotten these chair shots. But did Paul or anybody else come up to you and say, like, you know, Jack, this is how we do it around here. Let's either do it or not. Or was it just like completely forgotten?
Nobody, to my knowledge, ever said anything that night. Although a story that not a lot of people know, right after that match, I come back through the curtain. And just as I was coming through the curtain, whoever was up next or someone was getting ready, they were spraying hot stuff, which is something that's not used anymore. But it used to, you know, in the 90s, people would spray this hot stuff. It was a opposing oil that made you more vascular. And so I'm coming through the curtain breathing heavy, and they sprayed it, and I inhaled some of it. And I started having a bit of a anaphylactic reaction to it. My throat started closing up. So I ended up getting rushed right off to where the ambulance was. And I spent the rest of the night with an oxygen mask on my face trying to breathe. So I watched the majority of the rest of the show on a 2-inch monitor out by the ambulance with an oxygen tank on. I think I came back out at the end of the show when they did everybody in the ring for the thank you chants. But right after my match, I was moved out to the ambulance so I could breathe and get oxygen. So even if someone decided they wanted to chew me out for crappy chair shots, nobody did.
You were nearly killed by hot stuff at Barely Legal.
I don't know if I was almost killed, but I was having difficulty breathing for a while. Yeah.
Thank God. No. All right, everybody. Hold on 1 second, Mike. We'll get to this after the break. We got to head to our hourly break. And during the break, or not our hourly break, but anyway, during the break, I want you to think, Lance, what the hell ever happened to hot stuff? I remember that, believe it or not. Come back after the break. Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here, WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com, here every Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 Eastern, on the Sports Byline, USA Radio Network, Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 92, 94, 794, XM Radio, Channel 208, streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. And Lance, what the hell ever happened to hot stuff?
It got banned by WWE.
Really?
There was two or three guys that were allergic to it. And if you put it on and then went out and wrestled with them, they'd have a reaction.
Wow.
So I don't remember who it was. There was a couple names. For some reason, I think one of the smoking guns, I don't know if it was Billy or Bart, I could be completely wrong, but there was two or three guys that had bad allergic reactions to it. So WWE banned it. And then I think at some point, no, I don't think WCW did, but once WCW was gone, there really wasn't any place to use it anymore. So I think that was the last I'd heard of it.
I seem to remember it also, like, people would put it on because it kind of darkened you up a little bit, right?
Yeah, it would bring the blood to the surface, so you'd get a little darker and redder. It would, again, bring out the vascularity, so you looked really pumped. And it would also make you warmer, too. Like, I actually liked the stuff. Even after I had that bad incident in ECW, I still used the stuff. I just made a real effort to hold my breath and close my mouth and put it on, and then I would try to stay away from people if they were applying it. But other than that, I wore it and wrestled with it.
Wow, there's a reference here from 2001 to it, but I don't know if it's still around nowadays. That's a blast from the past. Now, you very quickly before we head to WCW, and it's funny, just to preface WCW, people, I know I did at least. I guess just because you held all of the titles, and you actually were pushed pretty hard in WCW. There's kind of that idea that you were there for like a long period of time, but really you were there for a very short period of time, and it was very, very near the end. And I don't know why in my mind I have you there from like, you know, 97, 98, 99, 2000. I mean, you weren't there during any of that period, but we'll get to that in a second. You mentioned booking. I guess, were you approached? Did you approach Paul? What were some of the programs and storylines that you had a hand in, and what were you really proud of?
I think what I liked the most was the drug testing, urine test I did with Tommy Dreamer.
Mm-hmm.
Don Callis played a part in that as well. I can't take sole credit for that, but that was a big one of mine. What first turned Paul on to me as a booker. It was Tammy Sitch's first night at the ECW arena. And I was wrestling Chris Candido, and we had to, they're putting the match together, and, you know, Dawn Marie gets in the ring. Tammy's going to strip her naked. He's trying to come up with down to her bra and thong, and then trying to come up with a spot that, you know, Tammy's skirt can come down so we can see her in her thong. And so it's like, there's the cat fight. Dawn gets stripped down. I grab Tammy, hold her for a suplex. Her skirt comes down this year, but, and then it's like, okay, how can we get to Chris pinning you from here? And everybody's tossing ideas. It's okay, we got to get Tammy out of there. We got to do this. We got to do that. And I was the one that pitched the idea, because Candido was using the Tennessee chain out of his boot at the time, of him just hitting me in the back of the head with the chain and knocking me out, and Tammy rolling the small package out of the suplex. And when I told Paul that, he's like, that's brilliant. That's perfect. And a lot of the other boys in the locker room was like, are you crazy getting pinned by a girl? I'm like, Candido's knocking me out with the chain. And also, too, with the ECW crowd, because I was a good athlete and did stuff, I'm like, this is something they can legitimately get onto me as a heel, is that you got pinned by a girl. I said, it's good heat. And Paul's like, he gets it. So we did the finish, and I even managed to get small packaged by her and have her butt pointing towards the hard camera, which everybody was quite grateful for. So the finish came off perfectly. And I was off and running as a heel from that point. And from that point on, Paul let me contribute a lot more to my own finishes, as well as contribute other ideas. And by the end, Tommy, Raven, Paul and I were sitting around booking TV each week.
Pretty impressive.
It was a lot of fun.
Now, did you, I mean, obviously you went to WCW and WWE, and did you ever get a chance to kind of get into this again, or did you ever have the desire? I mean, obviously you're not doing any booking now, but I mean, was it something that it was kind of like, I mean, obviously it would have been, you know, this was fun at the time, but I'm a wrestler, I'm a trainer. I mean, ever any desire to go back and do some booking?
I really liked it. And I never got to book, you know, angles so much again, although I did book finishes. Like, I don't think I ever, you know, even in WWE, you know, all the agents, I guess, had enough respect for me. It's like, they, unless it was a specific, you know, this is exactly what the creative team wants, I was never given finishes in WWE, and seldom even in WCW. It was, you know, they'd let you know who they want up, but unless there was a specific reason, it's like, I put all the near falls together, all the finishes together, and did all of that. And even in as early as Japan, when I was working for Tenryu with War, I remember a time when I was working with, you know, Koji Katao, and I was probably the least senior member in a six man. And Tenryu come in and said, you know, everyone, please, you listen to Lance. Lance, make a match tonight. And I put the entire match together, and the other five guys who were probably all senior than me had to listen to what I wanted. because I had been working for Tenru for a while, and he had obviously noticed that I was doing things the proper way. So I didn't get to push storylines and so forth. Although I did book for the PWA wrestling in Alberta.
That's right, yeah.
For a year or two. I really enjoyed it. But, you know, with the WWE creative, you don't really get a chance to pitch storylines too much. Although I did pitch them one really strong angle once when they didn't have nothing for me. And Michael Hayes is like, that's great. We love it. And Vince pulled me aside. It's like, that's really unique. We love it. And they never did it.
Which, go ahead, Mike. That was going to be my WCW segue.
Well, at this point, Lance, what are you thinking right now? Because obviously you grew up or you were more partial towards that wrestling style of WCW. At that point in your career, though, did it matter where you went as far as getting a call from someone? Or did you still think, hey, you know what, WCW is more my route compared to what's going on in WWE right now or WWF?
And actually, to add to that very quickly, you were a big fan of WCW growing up because it was a more serious style of wrestling, but you ended up going to WCW in about 2000 when it was very, very different than the NWA WCW of the 80s.
Yeah, it was a lot different. But when it came to, again, 2000, when it was, okay, WCW or ECW is having financial issues, you know, I need to find somewhere else to work. At that point, I wasn't thinking, you know, okay, this is more serious. I want to go here. I want to go there. It was really just, I thought WCW was a better opportunity. And I knew Paul had connections in WWE. And I really seriously thought that if I reached out to WWE, Paul's going to find out about it and squash it. So I found WCW sort of a better route to go to get out of ECW, which is why I ended up pursuing that front. I also thought they had more openings on their roster because the Radicals had just jumped over. So there was a glut of really great talent in WWE at that point in time. And I was like, boy, I don't know if they're going to have, you know, a room or a spot for me. But WCW perhaps might have room for somebody who can work.
But did you talk to people there? I mean, was it kind of like, I mean, was there any sort of back and forth, or was it just kind of like, WCW is a place to go for the time being?
I just wanted to find a job with a steady income, because I didn't think ECW was, long in the tooth, so to speak. And I really felt if I tried to reach out to WWE, Paul's going to find out about it and squash it. So I really just, I started to reach out to WCW first, and had success there right away. In that I started putting feelers out, and I ended up getting in contact with Terry Taylor. They set up a meeting. I met with Eric and Russo, and they offered me a deal that was quite financially good, and I took it.
Now, you, the name Vince Russo, a lot of people say a lot of different things. Some were big Russo fans. Some were thought Russo was just the absolute worst there ever was. And there were actually also some people that you know, they may have thought that Russo was a complete idiot, but he handled their careers all right. Where did you fall?
I'm not a big Russo fan. I think he's a very creative guy that has a lot of ideas. I think if you have someone else that can screen the ideas and use a few of the good ones and steer them better, he could be a benefit. But if left to his own devices, I don't think he has any respect for pro wrestling or that much of an understanding for it. So I'm not a big Russo fan, but that shouldn't surprise anyone. I've been fairly outspoken anti-Russo for years.
Now, you did end up with the three championships, the U.S., the Cruiserweight, and the Hardcore all at the same time. And you were pushed very strong. I mean, at the time, I mean, that was a weird time for WCW. I mean, the ship, I mean, it was pretty clear to a lot of people the ship was really sinking here. But, you know, there was still some good stuff here, some good stuff there. You kind of had to sift through a lot of it. I mean, a lot of people that were there at the time, you know, you're there, there's a war going on, you're doing your thing, you're not really watching the show. Maybe you're not even paying a lot of attention to the opposition. I mean, I once asked you a question. I can't remember what the question was, but your answer was like, I have no idea. I was working there at the time. What are your memories of that period in WCW?
I really enjoyed it. It was very busy. And I get a lot of people, it's like, how can you be critical of Vince Russo? He gave you the biggest push. And again, just because even if he was the one behind pushing me, doesn't mean he's smart. It just means that I ended up getting a good deal under his regime. But Johnny Ace and I started at the exact same time, John Laurinaitis. His first agenting gig was my first run-in gig. And I had talked with Johnny before about actually going to All Japan back at the end of 1994. So I knew Johnny a little bit. And I ended up benefiting more because of Johnny Ace than Vince Russo, in my opinion, because Johnny was coming in and trying to prove himself as an agent. And so he needed someone that could, you know, do the more complicated finishes, have better matches, because that's what his strong suit was. He's a really great finish guy. And I got told afterwards that it was actually a bet that Vince Russo didn't think there was anything in me because I was just a wrestler. And Johnny Ace, to try to show his chops, is like, well, give him to me. He'll be the hottest heel you have in 6 weeks. So I was a Johnny Ace project. And, you know, Johnny Ace was the guy that I talked to with, you know, what's your finish going to be? We're putting in this tournament. We're putting the U.S. title on you. We're giving you a push. He was my agent, and he was the guy that backed me. And it was, I think, Johnny trying to prove his value in making me that ended up benefiting my career.
All right, we're going to head to a break. When we come back, more WCW as well as WWE, The Invasion, The Alliance, so much more. Back in just a moment, everybody. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here, WrestlingObserver.com. We're joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. We're here every Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 6 Eastern, on the Sports Byline USA Radio Network. Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 92, 94, 794, XM Radio, Channel 208. Streaming live worldwide on the internet at WrestlingObserver.com. Joined today in studio by Lance Storm. We've been talking his career. It is the final long segment here on the program, so we're going to wrap up WCW and get into the WWE run. And Lance, as 2001, March of 2001 was closing in, and Doom was coming to WCW. It was a very interesting time to be a reporter, certainly, because a lot of stories going around, and a lot of stories from different perspectives. And it was pretty clear something was going down. In fact, even when the company had been sold and the writing was on the wall, there were still those people that thought, man, this thing is going to go on. This is all a big storyline. Bischoff's going to get someone involved to put this thing together. When did you know it's over?
I think the time that I knew 100% that WCW was no more was when there were WWF at the time, trucks in the parking lot in Panama City Beach on the last Nitro.
Yep.
And, you know, I think it was Shane McMahon, Pat Patterson, I think, and perhaps Gerald Briscoe, I'm not sure, were at the show. And they walked into the locker room and said, we're running the show now. That's when I knew for sure.
That's their exact words?
I know.
Okay.
Not their exact words, but
I pictured this like some sort of legit invasion. We're running the show now.
But that's when I knew for sure. And we'd heard a million things before that, but I don't know whether it was a week or month or whatever before that, but we had a big meeting with a Turner exec that came in that told us that Eric Bischoff and Fusion Media, whatever it was, have bought this thing. Eric Bischoff now is running WCW, their own WCW. We're letting him run and book things while we process all the paperwork, that the purchase will be finalized in the next few weeks, but he's now running the show. So we thought that was a done deal, and that fell through. So then no matter how much we had heard that, you know, Vince is buying it, this and that, I didn't believe any of it until Shane McMahon and Pat Patterson were standing in our locker room going, hey, well, we're really looking forward to working with you guys. It's like, oh, okay, I guess this is legit now.
It was amazing because Bischoff announced, well, not Bischoff, but whoever was doing the announcement. I mean, it was announced. It was officially announced that Bischoff and Fusion and the company had purchased WCW, and it was like officially announced before it was official. It was amazing.
Yeah, we had a Turner exec in the locker room telling us that it was, again, a done deal other than, you know, having all the I's dotted and T's crossed. We got to sign the final paperwork, but this is a done deal. And it wasn't a done deal.
How long did you know, as far as meeting with WWF, how long did you know that before you knew that they were going to pick up your contract? And what were you thinking at that time, too, now with WCW, you have all this flux and WWF's bought them. were you thinking about, okay, well, now I'm just going to try to get a job with WWF or see how it goes? Or were you starting to explore Japan and anywhere else you possibly could again?
I was talking a lot with Jeff Merrick at the time, who used to work for the law. He and I were good friends, and he had a few connections, and he was good friends with Chris Benoit, and I would imagine a few others, because he used to get a lot of read on what was going on in WWE. So I was talking to him a lot. And while, again, I wasn't confident that it was a 100% deal, I had been talking to him the week before the last Nitro, and he was, WWE's buying it. There's, you know, 10 names in WCW that they definitely want. You're on the list. Don't worry, your job's going to be safe. You're on the short list of guys they want to keep. So I was fairly comfortable that if, in fact, WWE was purchasing this thing, I was going to have a job. And if for some reason Eric Bischoff ended up keeping the thing somehow, I was going to have a job. So I may have been worried how it was going to play out, but I wasn't going, okay, I have to explore other options. It was really going to be who's going to end up with me. I was confident that one or the other wanted me.
Was it pretty cool to know that in an entire promotion, there were 10 guys whose contracts they really wanted to pick up and yours was on that list?
Certainly made me feel well, although in hindsight, it was probably more that there was 10 guys they couldn't afford.
It was affordable.
Yeah, that didn't want to. It was per the amount we have to pay him, we think he's worth it. But in either way, they wanted me. And I remember that night, I laughed because Shane McMahon came up and talked to me briefly and, you know, said, I'm really looking forward to working with you. And then he made an effort of using the if I can be serious for a moment line, but got it completely wrong. So it was a case of he was trying to put over that he's seen my work, but it's like, I don't think he's really seen much of it.
Well, how cool was it then, you know, after, you know, you have that happen, you end up with the debut of what's supposed to be the invasion of WCW, or what was the invasion of WCW. They were supposed to run house shows, obviously, and go that route, but to be the first guy to show up on WWF programming from WCW, was that a huge thrill? And how were you feeling going into that night? And were you nervous about anything? Because obviously one slip on WWF TV, that could have been it for you. And was there any butterflies going into that?
It was weird. And like the buyout, I had no advance warning. I was told that they were flying all of the talent to Connecticut for a meeting with Jim Ross just as an initiation. They told me they weren't going to bother flying me to Connecticut because WB was here next week. So just go to the arena. You'll have your meeting with Jim Ross when he's there. That's all they told me. So I showed up at the building that day to have my meeting with Jim Ross. And it was, you know, middle to late in the afternoon when Johnny Ace come by and says, you know, hope you brought your gear because you're working tonight. And I thought he was joking. I had brought my gear because it was in the trunk of my car. I always have my gear. But I'd be like, yeah, sure, Johnny, yeah, whatever. Ha, 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 funny, funny. And I, you know, blew him off. And then I think Dean Malenko or someone later in the day is like, oh, you're doing something tonight. I'm like, yeah, funny, funny, funny. So it wasn't until like probably 5 o'clock at night that I realized that, oh, crap, I'm actually doing something. So I had to go get my gear. And then it was just sort of a rush to get ready that I never really thought about it too much. But I was worried in that because I was running through the crowd without any entrance music or introduction, I'm like, is Calgary even going to realize that I am the Calgary guy running in? It's like, this is my hometown. WB is expecting a big reaction. If they don't recognize who I am, they might not pop. And I'm like, if they don't pop, I'm screwed. So I was really worried that they wouldn't have time to recognize who I was and react. But thankfully they did. The reaction went great. The thing in the limo with Shane went great and everybody was very, very happy with the reaction, how it went out. So I was very relieved, but I never really had a chance to sort of think about it ahead of time to go, wow, this could be big.
This may sound like a foolish question, but to somebody who hasn't wrestled and is a layperson, the ropes, I remember Arn Anderson talking about, you know, when he first went up to WWF, and this is obviously a long time ago, you know, he had to get used to the ropes and he almost killed himself a couple times because they were so loose into, you know, compared to how WCW was. Did, in hindsight or even at that time, does any of that stuff enter your, did that enter your mind at all as far as, you know, doing that top rope drop kick?
The top rope drop kick was WCW. I ran into a super kick. I didn't need the ropes.
Oh, okay.
But it was never an issue for me because Stampede Wrestling used a 20 by 20 ring with ropes. So the Stampede ring was actually very similar to a WWE ring. So I broke in on a ring with ropes, wrestled in, you know, WCW, ECW in Japan with cable, but I didn't have a problem with either. So it was old hat to me.
Now, I presume the infamous edition of Raw that took place on July 2nd, 2001, where Tacoma, Washington, the invasion died. I don't believe you actually were on television that evening, but you were there in the building, correct?
Oh, I was there.
What, my buddy Craig, who actually we had dinner with this evening, my buddy Craig was there, and like, I wasn't at the show. I don't even remember why. I have absolutely no idea why. Something must have been going down. But he was there, and he texted me after the show, and he just said they killed the town. And that's essentially what Vince McMahon thought as well, because that was pretty much the end of many of the ideas he had for WCW. And you were there that evening, and what were your thoughts when that show was over?
It was interesting, because Jericho still on occasion jokes about this. Booker and Buff did a couple house shows 2 weeks before and stunk the joint out. And then that weekend before that night, I did the house shows with Book, and we had good matches. And Jericho told me that there was a long debate in the production meeting that afternoon. Do we go with Booker and Buff or Booker and Storm? And there were two camps. And the decision at the last minute was made that Buff was a more identifiable name with WCW. We're going to go with Buff. And Jericho jokes with me occasionally that the whole invasion could have been different. He wonders what would have been different and how the invasion would have panned out if it had kicked off with Lance Storm and Booker T instead of Booker T and Buff Bagwell.
Let me ask you about that. Now, obviously, it would have been a much better match, and Vince would not have flipped his lid that evening, most likely. But to me, and I don't know what your feelings are, but I remember talking to people from WCW, and they mentioned the fact that they showed up backstage and they were given WCW shirts, and the WWE guys were given WWE shirts, and they said that, yes, you know, Vince owned this company, and it was only supposed to be a storyline rivalry, but the way that things were run backstage, I mean, it was designed to be like a real rivalry. And there are a lot of people that just feel from watching the whole thing that maybe it wouldn't have died if you had wrestled Booker T, but Vince McMahon's paranoia and his inability to put over these WCW invaders, I mean, one way or the other, it was going to end up the way it ended up. Do you kind of have that feeling, or do you think that Jericho may have been onto something and this could have been salvaged?
No, I don't think I would have had. The match would have been better, but it wouldn't have changed anything in the big scheme. You know, commentary was bad. The presentation was bad. And a lot of the booking later on, there was a feeling that there was times where comments would be made that you sort of questioned it. Do they realize we're on the same team? Every once in a while, there'd be little comments about WCW. And it's like, well, you realize we're on your side now, right?
You own us.
Yes. And we actually had separate contracts. Originally I had a WC, like I had to forego my WCW contract and signed a WCW/WWE contract. It was still a WCW contract, but it was under the WWE umbrella. And after, I think, a year or less, they ditched that contract and I had to sign another contract that was just a WWE contract. And it really wasn't until that second contract that we were really part of the same team. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I wasn't changing anything, but it would have been a better match, but that would have been about the only difference.
At first, pay-per-view did a gigantic number. To this day, it is still the most purchased non-WrestleMania pay-per-view of all time, the WWE Invasion, July 22nd, 2001. It's kind of funny in hindsight, the main event, the WCW-ECW Alliance, Booker T, DDP, Rhino, and the Dudleys against the WWF team of Austin, Kurt Angle, Jericho, Undertaker, and Kane. At the time, it was called the Inaugural Brawl, because I guess they were going to have this brawl every year. That didn't pan out.
No, and an interesting story, another great debate that I lost. There was, again, because Jericho was in production meetings or snooped real well, I don't know which. There was great debate on whether I should be in that main event or Rhino. That they were really, when they realized that there was almost no WCW guys actually in the main event, the you know, with the Dudleys and Rhino and everybody else. It was really a WWE heavy main event. And I was the name they were considering moving into that main event slot. Again, the last minute they went the other way, and I ended up being in the opener with Edge and Christian. But I was in contention for that main event match at one point.
All right, everybody, we're going to come back from the break in just a moment, and you'll find out how you can train to be a pro wrestler with Lance Storm. So stick around for that. Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network. We are back here. Final segment of the show. Brian Alvarez here, WrestlingObserver.com. Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. Lance Storm is here in studio. And Lance is now largely retired, matches here and there. But the main focus, his wrestling school. And if you would like to become a pro wrestler, no better place in the world to go than Lance's school. He's got students working all over the world, including in WWE Developmental. And Lance, tell us a little bit about how we can get more information about your school.
Stormwrestling.com is the best web address. You can go to stormwrestlingacademy.com as well. It'll take you to the same place. That's where there's information on my school. And unlike the schools I mentioned in the opening segment, I'm the name on the marquee and I'm the guy in the ring with you. I'm in the ring teaching you hands-on every day. I have matches with all my students by the end of class. Stormwrestlingacademy.com is where you can find out the information. I run 3 sessions a year. It's a 12-week program. We have a lot of fun, and you learn how to do this job well.
Storm Wrestling Academy. Head over to stormwrestling.com. There's a splash page. You can either go to the page with his personal page. It's got blogs up there, Q&As, a lot of pictures from throughout his career. Or you can head to the Storm Wrestling Academy page and all the information there about how to join the school. They do sessions 3 times a year, 12-week sessions. And when you're done, you get a match in the ring with Lance Storm. That is the main event, so to speak, of the school. And as noted, there are wrestlers from the academy working all over the world, including a number of stars right now that are down in WWE Developmental, the NXT promotion. Probably seen a lot of them if you watch NXT every week on television. Emma, the French Stallion, list goes on and on. All that is up at stormwrestling.com as well. And Lance, thanks again so much for doing the show today. It was a great time. And of course, thanks Mike, as always, all the folks at Sports Byline USA. You can always hear shows up at wrestlingobserver.com. Lance is a guest every other week, so make sure you head up there and check that out. And we will be back here live next week with a brand new show, 3 Pacific, 6 Eastern, so check it out. We are out of here. You are listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Broadcasting Network.